that they have now admitted were wholly false.
I'm elated. I've been vindicated. I've suffered 5 years of smear, trial by media. In fact, with the Jewish Chronicle, I managed to get them to change 15 stories. Over a period of less than 5 years, they have had almost 50 articles naming me in a negative way, which is like a vendetta. And I just decided this has got to stop. It's the Labour Party that has done this to me, because by kicking me out on totally false grounds, huge miscarriage of justice, in April 2018, they made it open season.
The judge in the British High Court described accuracy and truth as fundamental tenets of journalism, and explained that the allegations made by the Jewish Chronicle with regards to Mark Wadsworth fell short of both. The lies told by the Chronicle were one of many by British tabloid press, but Wadsworth hopes his legal victory will act as a deterrent for those that seek to smear him in the future. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Let the bodies pile on high in their thousands. A sentence seared into the memories of Britons, allegedly uttered by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he reluctantly approved a second England-wide lockdown late last year. Faced with fury from relatives of the bereaved, Johnson and his senior ministers emphatically denied the allegation. The man who made that claim, his former top aide turned nemesis, Dominic Cummings, back with more.
This is terrible, but the people who are dying are essentially all over 80. And we can't kill the economy just because of people dying over 80.
Speaking to the British public broadcaster, he also questioned his former boss's fitness for his role and rebuked the government's pandemic performance. Just like that time, the government denies the allegations, saying the Prime Minister has taken the necessary action to protect lives and livelihoods, guided by the best scientific advice. But the numbers speak otherwise. England had one of the worst per capita deaths among the world's major economies last year, blamed by many on lockdown dithering by the government.
It was even more than that. It was an ideological predisposition towards laissez-faire capitalism and not caring about the fate of the poor. And that's deeply entrenched. They thought, let it spread through the population. Yes, the old will die, but they could use that crisis actually to generate pressure to further pursue the policies they're pursuing anyway, which are not protecting the NHS.
The new allegations come only days after Number 10 made England the first country to lift almost all COVID-related restrictions, despite the rising number of cases, mostly of the Delta variant.
If you look at this Tory cabinet, they look like people who are totally unfitted for office because they simply don't care about the lives and quality of lives of the vast majority of the working people of Britain. That's not their remit. They are there to protect big business. They've shown that time and again. The fact of Cummings and Johnson falling out is just once again shedding light on what they would really like to bury, and no doubt they will try and bury when they're forced to have a COVID inquiry.
A public inquiry into the government's pandemic response is yet to happen, and it remains to be seen if these latest revelations from the Prime Minister's former advisor will seriously puncture his opinion poll rates or lead to pressure from members of his own party for him to step down. Saeed Forizam, London.
For thousands of years, the Nile River has meant life to people in a largely arid region. But today, the river is associated with an endless dispute. Ethiopia said on Monday that it had attained its second-year target for filling a mega dam on the Blue Nile, the Nile River's main tributary. The country said the plant may start generating power in the next few months.
We are now putting the turbines of what we call Unit 10. As soon as some important works are completed in a few months, it's all about connecting it to the transformers. And this will provide the biggest outcome of this work for the people of Ethiopia, which is generating electric power.
The project, called the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, has been at the center of a regional dispute since Ethiopia broke ground on the project in 2011. Egypt, a dry land home to nearly 100 million people, depends on the Nile for 97% of its water supply. and Sudan views the dam as a threat to its own dams and water stations, but Ethiopia deems the project essential for its development. A decade of negotiations under the auspices of the African Union has failed to result in a deal on the dam's filling and operations. The UN Security Council met earlier this month to discuss the project, but Ethiopia later slammed the session as an unhelpful distraction from the AU-led process. Experts say foreign powers' intervention throughout the years has only aggravated tensions in the region and that an African approach to the problem is needed.
I think the problem is the intervention of the imperialist countries, particularly the United States at this stage. So what has to happen is a more pan-African approach to this problem. Sudan and Egypt should sit down with Ethiopia and negotiate a policy which will benefit all three countries.
Once completed, the $4 billion project will produce more than 5,000 megawatts of electricity, doubling Ethiopia's power output. This is significant for an economy that frequently faces electricity shortages and is sometimes hobbled by power rationing. But Egypt considers the dam as a threat to its existence, and Sudan has warned that millions of lives will be at great risk if Ethiopia unilaterally fills the dam. Is a war between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia brewing on the Nile? The next few months might show if tensions explode into yet another hot conflict in the war-stricken continent.
The cleanup operation continues in Belgium and Germany, the countries worst affected by last week's devastating floods following torrential rainfall. Senior figures from the European Commission have just attended a meeting of EU environment ministers.
50 degrees northwest Canada, 40 degrees in Siberia, 40 degrees in Central Europe. The floods you've mentioned, the droughts agriculture is dealing with, wildfires.
Last week, the European Commission unveiled plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 27-nation bloc by 55% over the next 9 years. The Commission claims it's a matter of life and death.
The infernos and hurricanes we have seen over the last few weeks are only a very small window into what our future could look like.
Environmentalists point to what's happening right now. Raging wildfires in parts of the United States and Canada, severe flooding in regions of China, crippling droughts in areas of Iran, recent tornadoes in the Czech Republic. In order to save the planet, campaigners insist the EU must cooperate with big powers like Russia, China and Iran instead of pushing them away.
Official data shows transport accounts for 29% of pollution in the EU, but one large ship generates as much carbon dioxide per day as 80,000 cars. Of course, the aviation industry is another major player, and so too is agriculture. Experts say the key is to cut our energy consumption and be more efficient.
Therefore, what energy a country uses, what sources, what does it burn? Does it burn coal? Does it burn gas, which about has half the emissions of coal? Or does it do renewables, carbon-free sources? This is tremendously important for climate change.
Environmental groups say the EU needs to move faster and claims the bloc's goals are simply not ambitious enough. They are demanding that leaders agree on decisive action when they meet at a major UN climate change conference scheduled for October in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranian documentary film Life Among War Flags, which focuses on Afghanistan and the Taliban, directed by Mohsen Islamzadeh and produced by Press TV, has been unveiled in Tehran in the presence of the filmmakers. The documentary movie Life Among War Flags narrates a different story of conflicts between armed groups in Afghanistan. Moreover, it has made research on the role of the Afghan government in such conflicts.
I have been making documentaries for about 17 years now. The Life Among War Flags depicts the story of people whose region is controlled sometimes by the Taliban, sometimes by Daesh, and sometimes by a central Afghan government and the US forces. I believe they are the main victims of the war in Afghanistan. making this documentary film was very difficult because we had to risk our lives when we went among Taliban forces. We even took part in several Taliban operations to make this documentary film.
One of the special features about this documentary is that they have shown the inner side of the Taliban, which is very dangerous and difficult. Making such a documentary will definitely raise public awareness about the real nature of such groups, which is of course so risky for the filmmakers.
The production of this documentary took 19 months to complete. The documentary's director says it has unveiled a big secret called Taliban and clearly has responded to questions which have for long been formed in the minds of international audiences regarding the nature of the militant group. The documentary film, Life Among War Flags, takes a deeper look at the lives of Afghan people who have tolerated years of war and bloodshed under different names and have learned to show flexibility to survive. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
There seems to be no end in sight to the tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, the U.S. and some of its Western allies, including the U.K., have publicly accused actors affiliated with the Chinese government of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email platform used by corporations. That has escalated the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing, with the Chinese foreign ministry slamming it as, quote, fabricated allegation.
The U.S. has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept.
For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. Last week, China was infuriated further after the U.S. administration warned American companies and investors about the increasing risk of operating in Hong Kong. Washington claimed that those companies face multiple threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data foreign firms store there. The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. London has now announced it would permanently deploy two warships to Asian waters. That despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over their military activities in the region. It seems the U.S. and its allies are concerned about China's growing influence around the globe. That was visible in a recent G7 meeting where the leaders of seven wealthy nations agreed to counter China's economic and security influences. U.S. President Joe Biden even urged European and Japanese leaders to offer hundreds of billions in loans to developing countries in a direct challenge to Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's global infrastructure development strategy. Beijing's relations with Washington reached to the lowest ebb during the administration of President Donald Trump, who waged a tariff war on it. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under Trump's successor Joe Biden, but he has shown no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies toward China. That has helped bring the Asian powerhouse closer to Russia, with both forming an invisible alliance. Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington sees as a threat to its global hegemony.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah,
and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Well, the end to any privacy is the way Pegasus and Israeli spyware could be described. The malware for mobile phones has been spying on anyone from regular citizens to heads of states and journalists. The audio and video of one's phone can be turned on without the owner knowing it. And everything can be accessed, from old messages to notes on your phone contacts. Nothing is safe. How dangerous is this, and what can be done to stop it? We will be taking a look at all of this on the Spotlight.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Paula Odin, and Anas al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is, you know, something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire lives.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus, yet number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates.
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, author and researcher Daniel Gunja out of Barcelona, and journalist and commentator Ramiro Funes out of Los Angeles. Thank you both for being with us. Well, I'm going to start this off in Barcelona. And Daniel, we have heard for years that smartphones can listen in and even see its owners without them knowing. Tell me what is different about this Pegasus spyware and what makes it so much more dangerous.
The Pegasus spyware is able to be installed on the phone without the owner doing anything. It can be installed remotely without the owner having any idea that it actually is on their phone. It can access their messages, can access their camera, their microphone, and is basically able to have full control over all the content on their phone, which makes it very dangerous. Now, the issue with Pegasus had been raised previously. This is it is not new that what we know about the software. What is new now is, of course, the extent of how many people individually in higher positions have been targeted, which of course creates a completely new reality of a very global surveillance that is being the record has its source in the Zionist entity where it has been, where this software has been developed with the backing of the Zionist regime directly.
Let me go over to Ramiro. Daniel just said something about the Zionist entity, and I want to pick up on that as far as this being an Israeli company and the danger of that in general, because we know that it is a regime that does not abide by any type of international law at all. Ramiro, your take on that side of it.
That's exactly right. I think the Pegasus software is extremely dangerous. It is part and parcel of the Zionist method of control using intelligence abroad. The founders of the quote-unquote State of Israel understood the importance of controlling key aspects of infrastructure and trade, controlling the key trade routes of society, hence why occupied Palestine or the State of Israel is where it is today, because it sits at the key intersections of infrastructure in the Middle East. Now, applying that same logic to the 21st century, what are the key infrastructure points? The internet, WhatsApp, Google, Facebook, these are the points of infrastructure that are used all over the world daily by every single person. I don't know a single person who doesn't have a smartphone, who doesn't have these apps. And so now we can consider these applications, these devices as key infrastructure. And yet, once again, the Zionists have taken control of this key infrastructure, control the information that flows in and out, and see and monitor anybody who is in any way speaking out against their client governments. In Latin America, for example, one of the more lesser reported stories is that the Israeli government has been selling Pegasus, the Zionists have been selling Pegasus to the governments of Mexico, Honduras, and Colombia, three of which are key drug trading countries that are involved in the drug trade in the United States. And this software has been used to monitor, track, and assassinate activists, journalists who have spoken out against the crimes of the Mexican government, the Honduran government, the Colombian government, in collaboration with Mossad, with the IDF, with Israeli intelligence. So this is something that affects the entire world. It affects key infrastructure because everyone uses smartphone technology. And I think it's, again, part and parcel of the Zionist strategy of controlling the key points of infrastructure to make sure that nobody speaks out against their allies.
Daniel, your take on what Ramiro just said about as far as being selling this to certain governments. I want to look at the way that this malware can be used to control dissent, control whether we're talking about journalists, activists, and even sometimes heads of states. As we talked about earlier, that with this spyware, everything is accessible, which of course means very private information that could lead to blackmail.
It's dangerous in so many ways, especially because it is not only a tool that was developed by the Zionists, was developed by people who have ties to the Zionist regime and was approved by it. It was also promoted by the Zionist regime to be sold to different regimes, but also it is being sold, it is disseminated and used in different ways. And even in, if I remember correctly, in 2018, there was an article in the Zionist newspaper that there was an investigative report on how many countries and how many regimes have been using this particular software to spy, but not only to spy on journalists, human rights activists, lawyers, academics, but also to coerce and threaten and blackmail people or to persecute minorities. So this can effectively, of course, lead to an increase of state violence and can have drastic implications for individuals and for population groups, which is what makes it so dangerous on so many levels. But of course, it is part and parcel of the Zionist strategy because as much of other technologies and mechanisms that the Zionist regime is selling globally, it has consolidated itself globally as a force for the creation of methods of population containment and control that had been practiced and tested on Palestinians for at least the last 73 years. So much of the surveillance is tested in Palestine And in many ways, Pegasus is just one of the examples of the transnationalization of the violence against Palestinians, where Israel is using Palestinians and developing all sorts of methods that will help oppress people elsewhere and coerce people in key positions to effectively coerce them into making decisions, which gives, again, the Zionist regime even much more power, potentially.
I mean, Romero, I mean, would you say that this cyber surveillance is a new weapon? Obviously, that is quite dangerous. And what needs to be done in order to control it, just as we have other weapons that there are various laws with it? What do you think about that? What can be done?
Cyber surveillance is definitely a weapon, not only because it serves to monitor your actions, to make sure that you stay in line, to make sure that you don't criticize Israel, to make sure that you don't criticize the U.S., the Western countries, but it also serves as a weapon, a mass weapon of distraction. Here in the United States, where I'm speaking to you now from, every day there are new applications, methods, devices, content designed to distract and miseducate the population, to keep people misinformed, to not care about what's going on around the world. And I think that this cyber surveillance, it plays a role as well when we're talking about predictive behavior and data. Based on the words that you type on your phone, based on the words that you say in conversations with people, the big tech companies, which are 100% in collaboration with the Zionist entity of Israel, they use that data to predict your behavior and also to influence your behavior, to make it seem as if you want something that you really don't, to put content in your face and to want a desired outcome. And this is also used in the political sphere as well, where we see social media surveillance being used to promote regime change efforts in Cuba, to promote regime change efforts in the Middle East and all over the world. And so I think that cyber surveillance and spying and hacking is a huge threat, not only in terms of collecting data and keeping people in a low vibrational state of distraction, but also in terms of making you want something that you really didn't want. And I think in terms of correcting this, I think it really comes down to values. It really comes down to having progressive anti-imperialist governments realign the values of a society. I think Iran is doing a great job at that. I think countries like Nicaragua, Venezuela are doing a great job of that as well, where they're creating their own independent media companies, their own smartphone technology, their own devices that are free from some of the filth that we see in the Western societies, free from the hacking. And so I think it's really up to the anti-imperialist countries like Iran, like Russia, like China, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, to develop independent technologies and infrastructure so that they can't get to our technologies to begin with, to create things that aren't designed to distract us and keep us in a low state. Okay. And so I think that's it.
Well, what about that, Daniel? He just said about the, which I like, the weapons of mass distraction. And he talked about the anti-imperialist front. But as you know, the anti-imperialist front is continually under pressure, whether we're talking about economic sanctions or we're talking about in the media war, the soft war. And on the other hand, so when you're still using some of their platforms, as we saw with Press TV basically being shut down and taken off of .com, so where do we go with this? On the one hand, the pressure is on economically. On the other hand, if we use their platforms or use their smartphones, now we see the situation with actually the Israeli regime being in control of most of it.
Rather a dilemma, and I agree that there need to be new ways to be found in order for anti-imperialist factions to develop different kinds of, maybe through a collaboration of alternative media. I mean, Press TV has, this example you mentioned, when Press TV's domain was bought, Press TV managed very swiftly to use a different domain and still to continue its program without any major interruption, which showed that even those threats or direct forms of intimidation coming from the U.S. regime have been able to, Press TV was able to circumvent them. But of course, the danger is there, and effectively there would need to be different ways to find alternative platforms that can be used. But also, I agree with what the other guest said, it's of course also a question of values, because as long as there is this imperialist structure, and as long as the Zionist entity exists, we will be faced with such challenges, because effectively even this cyber spying is just a digitalized form of different forms of spying that the Zionist entity has been employing for so many years, such as the conventional spying, where they would spy and conduct targeted assassinations against people. And these days, these things take place rather in online spaces. But there needs, of course, to be a continuous effort from within the resistance axis and from the resistance to counter these efforts, and of course, to remain aware of them.
Well, Romero, why aren't we seeing a stronger reaction from Western governments? Because also some of them have been targeted. We saw that Emmanuel Macron of France, of course, was one of those that was targeted. And I mean, we have seen the reports coming out about Saudi Arabia and UAE, these authoritarian countries like this using it to silence dissent. So these countries that at least try to say that they support human rights, some of these Western governments, why aren't we even hearing anything coming out of, for example, Washington or London in condemning this spyware?
I think Washington and London will never condemn any of the crimes of Israel and the Zionist entity, because it falls in line exactly with their foreign policy goals. When we're talking about the victims of these cyber attacks in the Middle East, we have, you know, targeting against Palestinians, against people in Yemen, against people in Afghanistan, Iran, and then in Latin America as well, you know, you have journalists, activists, academics in Mexico, Colombia, Honduras, countries that are neo-colonies of U.S. imperialism. All of that benefits the interests of Wall Street and the London Stock Exchange. And this is the new level and the new frontier of the war in the 21st century. We're no longer in the era of frontline soldiers and infantry combating each other. We're in a communicational war, a digital war of data, where if you have more data and information from your enemy, you can control them more. You can even predict their behavior. The technology with AI and algorithms, it's so advanced that you can manipulate a whole society into believing something that is not true. And so I think the reason why the Western countries will never call out Israel is because they're in fact collaborating with Israel to use this technology against their enemies, against their oppressors, and they're using this as a way to enter the next frontier of imperialism in the 21st century. And it's something that's very scary, and that's why I'm very proud of countries like Iran and Russia and China and others in the anti-imperialist bloc that are developing independent technology, because the second you agree to use their infrastructure, their technology, their apps, you're making yourself vulnerable to their exploitation, to them surveilling you if you speak out against them. And so it's so important for us to develop the next level of defense, a frontier, our own technologies, our own applications. And I think that's what it's going to take.
Daniel, what do you think about as for the possibility of a grassroots global movement in trying to get this type of spyware to be banned or to be deemed illegal? The possibility of that side of things?
As long as governments are continuing to use the spyware, I don't see much probability of that. Of course, now there is an awareness of the spyware, but still, like, even in the Western media, it hasn't been the Israeli role in it hasn't been as highlighted as much as it could have, and it has continued to be used by governments that, as you said, at least pretend that they are interested in human rights, while at the same time, of course, it also serves the Zionist regime to connect with its newfound allies. It has sold the software to the regimes in Saudi and Bahrain and UAE and so on, who don't even pretend that they care about human rights. So effectively, I do not think that could lead to the software being banned. And even if the Zionist regime has been promoting itself as a technological hub, as a very advanced digitalized entity, so I wouldn't be surprised if they have other softwares, if they're already developing other things that they can use to continue spying on. And as long as they have Palestine as a testing ground, as a laboratory, where they are abusing Palestinians to develop all sorts of technologies, I do not see that there is a potential end to that coming from even from grassroots, as long as it's in the Western imperialist framework.
Well, what about the Ramiro, Daniel just talked about the Zionist regime and how it, even with this, even with the spyware, they're using it to try to promote themselves, like they are above the rest. Just from the, we know they use, from a military perspective, they use a lot of propaganda to say that they're the strongest and the most moral. And now in dealing with technology, it's as if they want to say, we are superior, we are above the rest, and sort of an intimidation factor. What can be done about this? And what do you think about resistance media and the role of basically educating people to what's going on? Your take on what needs to be done on that side of things.
I think that's such a great point. One of the talking points of the Zionists is that Israel is a free, is paradise. You can do whatever you want. They boast about engaging in behavior, decadent behavior, in behavior that's immoral and behavior that is against traditional values. And Israel posits itself as a land of high-tech freedom, of unlimited access to whatever you want. And even within the internet realm, we also see the same thing happening with a lot of the adult content that a lot of Israeli companies have been supporting in the United States and the Western Hemisphere, that they're strongly connected to that. And it's something that is really hard for us in my generation, especially as a millennial, to really understand, because when they compare themselves to more traditional countries, Islamic countries that are preserving morals and values, that are not engaging in this online behavior, they make it seem as if they're better. And that's part of the chauvinism and the arrogance of Israel. They say that they're free, they're advanced, they're in the future, but they make a false equation of being advanced and high tech with being decadent, with being lewd, with being all sorts of kind of things. And I think it's important for a new culture to emerge online that is not based on lewd adult content, that is not based on some of the arrogance, on the decadence that we see on social media and on media platforms in general that highlight gross wealth and fame and luxury cars. We have to create a new culture and a new technology based around families, based around traditional living, based around anti-imperialism, preserving our way of life aside from the empire. And okay. I think that this is the only way out.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this program. Author and researcher Daniel Jędrzejczyk out of Barcelona and journalist and commentator Ramiro Funes out of Los Angeles. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. while Europe's right-wing parties remain committed to the ridiculous and baseless notion that Muslims, immigrants, and refugees pose a threat to Europe's overall security and unique secular identities, the left is not entirely immune from such chauvinistic notions, says Ramzi Barood, journalist, in an article published under the heading Progress or War on Islamophobia and Europe's Demographic Shifts. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Europe's identity crisis is not confined to the ceaseless squabbles by Europeans over the EU, Brexit, or football. It goes much deeper, reaching sensitive and dangerous territory, including that of culture and religion. Once more, Muslims stand at the heart of the continent's identity debate. Of course, anti-Muslim sentiments are rarely framed to appear anti-Muslim. While Europe's right-wing parties remain committed to the ridiculous and baseless notion that Muslims, immigrants, and refugees pose a threat to Europe's overall security and unique secular identities, the left is not entirely immune from such chauvinistic notions. The right's political discourse is familiar and is often condemned for its repugnantly ultra-nationalistic, if not outright racist, tone and rhetoric. The left, on the other hand, is a different story. The European left, notably in countries like France and Belgium, framed their problem with Islam as fundamental to their supposed dedication to the secular values of the state. A problem arises when, in the name of religion, some want to separate themselves from the Republic and therefore not respect its laws, Macron said during a speech in October 2020. Leftist politicians and intellectuals were just as eager as the right to prevent Ihsan Houch, a Belgian government representative, from serving as a commissioner at the Institute for the Equality of Women and Men, IEFH. Again, both sides joined forces. Although without an official declaration of unity to ensure Houch had no place in the country's democratic process, it was a repeat of a similar scenario in France last May, when Sarah Zemahi was removed from the ruling party's candidates list for seemingly violating France's valeur de la République, or the values of the Republic. These are but mere examples and are badly and hardly restricted to French-speaking countries. There are many such disquieting events pointing to a deep-seated problem that remains unresolved. In Britain, Rachia Ismail was celebrated as the country's first hijab-wearing mayor in May 2019, resigned from her post less than a year and a half later, citing racism and marginalization. While the Belgian, French, and British media elaborated on these stories as if unique to each specific country, in truth, they are all related. Indeed, they are all the outcome of an overriding phenomenon of an anti-Muslim prejudice coupled with a wave of racism that has plagued Europe for many years, especially in the last decade. Though Europe's official institutions, mainstream media, sports clubs, and so on continue to pay lip service to the need for diversity and inclusion, the reality on the ground is entirely different. A recent example was the horrific outcome of England's defeat in the Euro 2020 final against Italy. Gangs of white English, mostly males, attacked people of color, especially black people, whether on the street or online. The extent of cyberbullying, in particular targeting dark-skinned athletes, is almost unprecedented in country's recent history. Various British officials, including Prime Minister Boris Johnson, condemned the widespread racism. Interestingly, many of these officials have said or done very little to combat anti-Muslim hate and violence in the past, which often targeted Muslim women for their head or face covering. Strikingly, Johnson, purportedly now leading the anti-racist charge, was one of the most disparaging officials who spoke demandingly of Muslim women in the past. Of course, Islamophobia must be seen within the larger context of the toxic anti-refugee and anti-immigrant sentiments, now defining factors in shaping modern European politics. It is this hate and racism that served as the fuel for rising political parties like Le Front National in France, Vlaams Belang in Belgium, the Freedom Party in Austria, and the Liga in Italy. In fact, there is a whole intellectual discourse complete with brand new theories that are used to channel yet more hate, violence, and racism against immigrants. And where is the left in all of this? With a few exceptions, much of the left is still trapped in its own intellectual hubris, adding yet more fuel to the fire, while veiling their criticism of Islam as if genuine concern for the secularism. Oddly, in Europe, as in much of the West, crosses and stars of David as necklaces or the Catholic nun's head covering, velo del sor, let alone the kippahs, their religious tattoos, and many other such symbols are all part of Europe's everyday culture. Why do we never hear of such controversy of a Jewish man being tossed out of a public building because of his kippah or a white French woman being expelled from university for wearing a cross? The matter has less to do with religious symbols in general than of the religious symbols of races and peoples who are simply unwanted in Europe. Also, limiting the discussion to refugees and immigrants may give the impression that the debate is mostly concerned with the non-European others who are invading Europe's shores, determined to replace Europe's original white Christian inhabitants. This is hardly the case, since a sizable percentage of Belgians and French, for example, are themselves Muslims, estimated at 6% and 5% respectively. Namely, these Muslims are European citizens. Ouch, Zemahi and Ismail actually wanted to be a part of, not break apart from, these societies by honoring their country's most cherished political traditions, yet without erasing their own cultural heritage and religious identities in the process. Alas, they were all vehemently rejected, as if Europe has made a collective decision to ensure that Muslims subsist in the margins forever. And when Muslim communities try to fight back using Europe's own judicial system as their supposed saviors, they are once again rejected. The latest of such spans was in June, when Belgium's constitutional court resolved that prohibiting the wearing of hijab does not constitute a violation of freedom of religion or the right to education. It is time for European countries to understand that their demographics are fundamentally changing, and that such change can, in fact, be beneficial to the health of these nations. Without the true diversity and meaningful inclusion, there can be no real progress in any society anywhere. But while demographic shifts can offer an opportunity for growth, it can also inspire fear, racism, and predictably violence as well. Europe, which has fought two horrendous wars in the last century, should know better.
morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.